طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. The issue we explore this week is water. Water in Palestine, Israel, and how that relates to Massachusetts. We have two presentations recorded at a forum on water that took place October 2nd at Tufts University. The first presents an historical perspective of the Israeli-Palestinian water struggle by Elaine Hagopian, and the second is a description by Nancy Murray of a local campaign to challenge a compact by Israel and Massachusetts to collaborate on water issues. The introduction of the speakers is by Tufts professor Amal Bishara, who is also a Palestinian activist.
We are lucky to be in this fantastic town of activists, and I have to say that one of the reasons why we have this fantastic town of activists and academics who come together on nights like this is because we've had Elaine Hagopian in our community for so long. And so Elaine Hagopian is Professor Emerita of Sociology from Simmons College. She's an incredible institution builder for Arab Americans and has been for so many years. She was one of the founders of the Association of Arab American University Graduates. She's been active. One of the amazing things about you, Elaine, is that you work on local projects like Arabic Hour, which has been a 30-plus year community television show that has actually broadcast at various points very widely, but really has a strength in being about the community here as well. And then the Arab American stuff, and then also working on great issues of global size. Really one of the leaders of the right of return movement here in this country, and also an expert on water. So we're delighted to have you with us. Well, you are. And we're very lucky to have you with us this evening to speak.
Thank you.
And we are recording this event just audio.
I thought I had agreed with Amal that we'd have a one-sentence introduction, but I'm embarrassed, so forgive me, I'm catching my breath. Anyway, I'm happy to be here this evening, and they told me I have 15 minutes to speak. Now, it was 20 minutes, and so what I did tonight before I came is I talked to myself very fast, and it was 15 minutes. So I don't know if I can talk that fast again, so bear with me. My task this evening is to try to talk a little bit about the history of water proposals in the area. And I'm going to start by noting that in 1899, this was after the Basel meeting in which the World Zionist Organization decided to try to go for a state. But in 1899, they commissioned an Abraham Borchardt to go to Palestine to study the Jordan River Basin. I had maps up here that had the 1919 map, but I think that they're all gone. I might have one extra. Well, no, it was yes, that one. Anyway, if you all have copies, it would be helpful for you. It's the 1919 map that the World Zionist Organization presented to the Paris Peace Conference. Chaim Weizmann, who was the president of the World Zionist Organization, presented it and basically spelled out what was to be the main theory, the main approach of the Zionist movement with regard to water, up to the very present, and it's become more elaborated as we've gone along. So there was the 1899 study, and the 1919 map shows you the area that the Zionists wanted as a Jewish state, And it includes all of the water, main water resources in that area. If you look at it, it includes southern Lebanon, the Golan Heights, the east, even the east bank of the Jordan River, and part of the Sinai. And we'll talk more about that map later. In any case, Chaim Weizmann said at this meeting, the whole economic future of Palestine, and mind you, it's 1919, so it was still called Palestine, the whole future of Palestine is dependent upon its water supply for irrigation and for electrical power, and basically to ensure a European style of life for the immigrants that they expected to come. And the water supply must mainly be derived from the slopes of Mount Hermon, the Golan Heights area, from the headwaters of the Jordan River, which are actually in the Golan Heights, and from the Jordan itself and from the Litani River in Lebanon. And you can see on the map that they go up 25 miles into Lebanon to come to the Litani River, which feeds into the Golan Heights area. And that's a basic theme of the Zionist approach with regard to water, that they must control it if they are to have a real state and attract people to come into it and for their development. In 19, there were a lot of proposals that came after that, but I'm going to go to two proposals before 1948 that mark out, in a sense, a debate between what the Israelis wanted and what initially the West, in the form of Britain, wanted, and later the Arabs. In 1939, the British commissioned a man by the name of Ioannides, I-O-N-I-D-E-S. And this was after the Peel Commission had talked about partitioning Palestine. It was after the disturbances in 1930s. And so they sent him, and they were assigned him to prepare a study of water resources in preparation for the possible partition of Palestine. And the main conclusion that Ioannidis came to was the following, and this is very important. This is one side of debate. Main conclusion was that irrigation waters of the Jordan River were to be used primarily within the Jordan Valley Basin. Look at where the Jordan River is on that map, and the basin is, of course, around that. And not to irrigate the Negev and other areas. In other words, not southern Palestine at that time or what is now southern Israel. So that was the conclusion of the 1939 plan, which didn't work out. In 1944, Walter Clay Loudermilk, an American Zionist, went to Palestine, and his plan called for the irrigation of the Jordan Valley, diversion of the Jordan and Yarmouk rivers, which are up near the Golan Heights, and to the Negev, divert it to the Negev in the south, and the usage of the Litani River in Lebanon for projects in what was to become Israel after 1948. So if you hear that position, which now talks not about the Jordan Basin, but diverting the waters into what became Israel and into the Negev, and basically to water the whole area. So that was plan, which the Israelis, or the Zionists at the time, 1944, agreed with. They even named had a statue of Loudermilk, named a building after him. And that plan, and basically, becomes the basis of what the Zionists do after that in terms of what they want. Now, I'm going to talk about post-1948, and I'm going to talk about it in two parts. So the first part will be on the Jordan Valley water development area. It will be around the river, the Golan Heights, and in other words, the area that you see on the map. And part two will be on, after 48 and 67, will be on within Israel and the occupied territories. All right, so I'm going to talk about the Jordan Valley water development first. So think in terms of the river, the Golan Heights, and the diversion of that water. Before I get to that, I just want to let you know that there is a context after 48 for understanding some of the things that went on. One of these contexts, of course, was the Cold War. There was the competition between the U.S. and the Soviet Union for influence in this area. So I'm going to give you the positions of the three main actors with regard to water and its politics in this context of the Cold War and in the context of the desire of the Zionists to have a Jewish state based on that 1919 map. So let's talk first about Israel after 1948. Israel wanted to control all water resources as per the 1919 map and the land on which they are found, of course. They wanted to thin out the Palestinian population within what was mandated Palestine and others as they went along in the areas. For example, in the Golan Heights, we have refugees that left that area. And they wanted to extend, here's the same thing, extend the water resources from Litani, the Golan, the Jordan River, beyond the Jordan Basin to the Negev and throughout Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories after 1967. That was their position. It's basically derived from the Loudermilk plan. The Arabs, after 48, their position was they wanted to get their fair share of water. Remember, they were just coming out of colonialism for the most part. They wanted to avoid normalizing relations with Israel, that is, integrating Israel into the area through shared water schemes and development projects. And they wanted to avoid schemes to resettle Palestinian refugees outside of their original homes and properties through proposed, we'll see later, proposed water jobs projects aimed at negating United Nations Resolution 194 calling for the right of return. So UNRWA was very much involved in this in the early days, that they were given a lot of money by the U.S. and even Great Britain to try to resettle the refugees outside of what became Israel. So the Arabs were concerned about water projects as leading to normalization with Israel, recognition of Israel, and resettlement of the refugees. The U.S. position was, in this area, to ensure Israeli statehood and everything needed to make it viable, including water. They wanted to use water resources in the area to create Arab-Israeli cooperation and Israel's regional integration and recognition. In other words, make them work together so then the Arabs will recognize them, so forth. A major part of that effort was to use water strategy to resettle the refugees in the Jordan Valley. There's a catch. At that time, of course, in 48, it was not under occupation. It was not until 67. And thereby, by settling them in the Jordan Valley, they would neutralize the right of return. Israel wanted the refugees resettled, but not in the Jordan Valley, because it coveted that Jordan Valley, which it saw itself getting at a later stage. Ben-Gurion used to talk about two stages of Zionism. You get what you can initially, and then you expand. And you know the Jordan Valley today is well controlled by Israel. It's in Area C, basically. Now, let me talk now, after I've laid out all these positions, about Part 1, the Jordan Valley Water Resources Plans. And here I want to bring to your attention that there are riparian protocols that are supposed to be observed. What is meant by that, of course, is that if you have water resources between countries, either on the borders or the water is flowing into each other's countries, they are supposed to, under international law, which has not been fully codified, but certain principles have been accepted, they're supposed to share those waters equitably. And the U.S. was very much involved in trying to get a riparian protocol going in the area. So, but in 1953, before the American plan, which I'll spend time on, Israel put forth a seven-year plan. And the seven-year plan centered around diversion of Jordan River water south to the Negev desert and establishing and working on establishing a unified and comprehensive water network that would be developed under a national water carrier project that would cover all parts of Israel and be ready for the 1967 extension into the occupied territories. What the Americans did, because there was a lot of unrest and there were a lot of shooting going on over water in the early 1950s, and the U.S. dispatched Ambassador Johnston to the area to work out a water plan. Now, one of the disturbances, the major one, the Israelis had entered in 1951 the demilitarized zone area between Israel and Syria. And they had moved up into that, which was against the terms of the demilitarized zone. They had moved up into the Hula Valley, which is at the foot of Golan Heights, which has a lot of water. And they wanted to drain the swamps there and to begin that project as part of the network. The U.S. basically put a stop for a bit, but that project was completed in 1958 in the demilitarized zone. Now, so Johnson came in 1953 to 55. He had 2 years of negotiations. The Arabs were wary of recognizing Israel and agreeing to Israeli control over Arab waters or to bury the rights of the refugees. But the Arabs were finally convinced by Johnson, after 2 years of negotiations, that they were simply agreeing to riparian allocations of water, even though Israel got more than its fair share in this negotiations. So they thought that, okay, we don't have to do any projects with them, we just have to have technical relations to make sure that we have the proper allocations. So they agreed. And after this plan was put forward, Dulles, Secretary of State Dulles, made a very stupid announcement. And that stupid announcement basically was that, which renewed Arab apprehension. He said that in order to secure a lasting and stable peace in the Middle East, the United States would pay adequate compensation for the Arab refugees, meaning they wanted to resettle them and get rid of them. They would underwrite some of the expenses for a regional water development project, and they would guarantee new and permanent political boundaries which would replace the old armistice lines. This was in 1955. This alerted the Arabs that they were going to be taken in to try to recognize Israel and that the refugees were somehow to be resettled without a right of return. Dulles, by this statement, reinforced Arab refusal to recognize the state of Israel or embark on measures of cooperation with it. The interesting thing is, the Israeli cabinet discussed the plan, and they didn't take a vote, because, again, they were afraid the refugees would be settled in the Jordan Valley, which they coveted in the future. And so they didn't take a vote on that plan. And the Arabs, the Arab Council, after the announcement of Dulles, refused to ratify the plan. And so as a result of the failure of multilateral riparian allocation of water, it's now failed, they all went their separate ways. It was unilateral action with regard to water in the Jordan Valley area. And Israel, because of its technologically advanced ability, was able to develop use of the water to a higher degree and to divert some of those waters for its own needs. More importantly, during this period of time, the Israeli National Water Carrier Project was restarted in 1955 and completed in 1964. The carrier took water to all parts of Israel from the Jordan Valley with potential for covering the future areas. At this time, the Litani was sort of dropped out of the Israeli vernacular, but not forgotten. But it was dropped. Now, if we go on to the second part of within Israel and the occupied territories, as opposed to the Jordan River, in 1948, the Zionists, as you know, conquered 78% of Palestine, and it drew Israel drew most of the its water from the western aquifer. Those who have maps can see the western, and that's the most productive of the aquifers, which overlaps Israel and the West Bank. Most of the water comes out of the West Bank. The coastal aquifer, which is Gaza and Israel, and the Sea of Galilee, Tiberias, and gained the Jordan River Basin, as we already discussed, as well as Hula area in the DMZ. These all got tied in together through the national carrier. So they tied in all these resources through the National Carrier Project. And, you know, that company is called, I can never pronounce it, Mekarot. Mekarot, is that right? No. That's the company that Palestinians now have to buy their water from, because Israel controls all the water and they never get enough water. So they have to buy the rest from Israel, from that company, from their national carrier. After 1967, they captured the rest of Palestine and the water-rich Golan Heights. That is the most water is found, congeals there, and the headwaters of the Jordan River are there, and they captured that area. So, and they also, the Sinai, which they, which they're out of because the U.S. Pulled them out. As you know, they had settlements in Sinai, and the U.S. pressured, and they finally got an agreement with Egypt, and the peace treaty with Egypt was more important. Now, Israel, in the occupied territories, pursued a policy through military orders. In other words, they create laws in order to take over the water. So they was under military administration at the time, and the orders were 92 in 1967, immediately after the war, and order military order 291, 1968, which allowed Israel to monopolize access to water in the occupied territories and routinely deny Palestinians the right to drill wells or repair existing ones. So the water control in all of Palestine is now complete. There were other things that happened in between, but we get up to 1995, Oslo II. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because I talked about it last time, but I'll just simply mention that the Interim Agreement on Water, which is Article 40 on water and sewerage, is masterfully vague. The Interim Agreement institutionalizes the existing system of water control and exploitation, and then some. The wall has exacerbated the issue of water and access to water for irrigation, especially where the wall cuts you off. The settlements within the West Bank and the wall extend into Palestinian territory and eat up a lot of water. And so the situation for water for Palestinians is very, very dire, to say the least. We know that Oslo created a joint water committee with equal numbers of Palestinians and Israelis to govern water through Oslo. However, in order for Palestinians to build any infrastructure or do anything with water, they had to get a permit from Israel, and the Joint Committee, even though they were even numbered, if they didn't get the majority, get the Israeli vote, that they had effectively a veto over projects. So none were really agreed to, or very few. So that it's very important if you have a chance to read Article 40 of 1995, of the interim agreement. There were other reasons why Israel went into Oslo, and basically, without getting into it, it was to fill out, was an easier way to fill out that 1919 map. And I think, you know, that map is very important. You can also get it on the internet, and it says 1919. I don't know why that didn't come out here. So let me finally just say two things. One, the Israeli policy that Chaim Weizmann indicated at the beginning in 1919 to the peace plan is still in force, and Ministry of Agriculture in 1989 spells it out even more. The representative said, it is difficult to conceive of any political solution consistent with Israel's survival that does not involve complete, continued Israeli control of the water and sewerage systems and the associated infrastructure, including the power supply and road network essential to their operation, maintenance, and accessibility. So this statement was made before Oslo. It still governed the way they looked at it. They talked about Palestinian rights to water, but never spelled it out, and postponed it to the final agreements, which they never got to. That's 20 years later now. So this continues to inform Israel's position on water. The final word is on the Lotani, which was part of the 1919 map. You know, in 1982, Israel invaded Lebanon, and while it had some of its flunkies occupying in the south, it remained there, and it occupied the area, southern area, until the year 2000.
Could you spell that river?
L-I-T-A-N-I.
Thank you.
Yep, Lotani. And when they had to leave in the year 2000, it was was understood that they had been draining water from the Litani. Now, I don't know, and I can find out nowhere, whether they are still getting water somehow from the Litani because of pipes or whatever. I have no idea, so I want that to be clear. But as you know, when they left Lebanon, it was because of the Israeli mothers of soldiers who, in a sense, wanted them out, and also Hezbollah was very active.
Thank you. It is my great pleasure to introduce Nancy Murray, who has been an activist for peace and justice in the Middle East since 1988, when she made her first visit to the West Bank and Gaza. And she has also been the education director for the ACLU of Massachusetts, so she's worked on human rights internationally and locally, and also been an incredible leader in our movement and a great inspiration for me. All right, but it's true. I have pictures of you in demonstrations in the 90s when I was a student.
Really?
Yeah. So I mean it.
I had long hair in those days. Well, great panel so far, and I'm going to bring it back to this country. I think what I have to say will fit right in with what you've heard, and you will all get geared up to sign the sheet up here saying, get involved in our work. I'm speaking now on behalf of an organization called the Boston Alliance for Water Justice, which emerged as a response to a Boston Globe article, which was published in November 2013. It was an article about the, quote, innovative water partnership that Massachusetts was forming with the State of Israel. I'm going to read you the headline to Aaron Aylworth's piece, and I say read it because it's quite long. This is the headline, quote, in Israel, water where there was none. Necessity and ingenuity made Israelis leaders in water technology. Now, seeing vast global potential, they are teaming up with Massachusetts innovators. That's the headline. She went on to describe in glowing terms the water miracles wrought by Israel that, quote, her words, forced the desert to recede, end quote. And having just returned from a trip to Israel in the West Bank, I was well aware of the heavy price that Palestinians under occupation and Palestinian citizens of Israel were paying for what Aylworth termed, quote, this modern version of the land of milk and honey, end quote. I mean, all the stereotypes were in this article. On our trip, wherever we went in the West Bank, we encountered the stark inequality you have heard of just now. We saw Israelis who are now more than 500,000 in the West Bank. They're probably now close to 700,000 settlers in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. They use more than 80% of the water from the West Bank's three principal aquifers, leaving less than 20% for Palestinians. Recent studies estimate that Israeli water consumption is 5 or 6 times higher than Palestinian water use on a per capita basis. And that was really visible because you would see what Amal has shown, you know, people trying to collect water whatever way they can to store it on their roof in the West Bank. Well, you know, Israeli settlements have swimming pools. You've all seen this, you know, green lawns, etc. So combined with house demolitions, the fragmentation of Palestinian territory by walls, military checkpoints, closed military zones, and settler-only roads that are off-limits to Palestinians, water has become a lethal weapon in Israel's decades-long battle to dispossess Palestinians of their land and livelihoods. Now, water has also been used as a weapon against Israeli citizens, especially Bedouin citizens of Israel. It's been used as a weapon against Palestinians further north, but we saw on our trip what was happening to Bedouins. When we traveled to the village of El Arakib in the Negev, which was one of 35 unrecognized villages in the desert that get no services of water from their government. Remember, these are Israeli citizens. El Arakib, where Bedouin have lived since early last century, has been repeatedly raided since 2010. Its houses have been demolished over 80 times. When we were there, it was 50 times. Now it's 80. That was 2 years ago, 50. Its thousands of olive trees have been uprooted, its sheep sprayed with herbicides, and its water sources seized. The Jewish National Fund, which is a central actor in clearing the Negev, just as you saw, it was a central actor in clearing what was, you know, taken over in 67 and 48. It has removed, its plan is to remove forcibly between 30,000 and 70,000 Bedouin, to take them off their land and put them into these very grim, poorly serviced townships. In their place, the JNF, the Jewish National Fund, is planting swiftly growing eucalyptus trees, which we saw. They were about this big all along the desert landscape. While Israel chose not to pipe water to Bedouin communities, it is now ignoring sound ecological practice by irrigating notoriously water-greedy trees in the desert. So, of course, none of this appeared in Erin Aylworth's article. Instead, she wrote with enthusiasm about the collaboration between Massachusetts and Israeli water industries, which grew out of a March 2011 meeting in Tel Aviv between then-Governor Deval Patrick and Buki Oren. Buki Oren was the former head of the national carrier, Mekorot, which you heard about earlier. Oren wanted to launch Israel's water technology onto the world stage, and he saw Massachusetts and Israel, he said, as, quote, natural partners. Patrick was so intrigued by the idea that the following year, his administration encouraged about 50 Massachusetts policymakers, venture capitalists, academics, lawyers, businessmen, and a few elected officials to undertake a, quote, water innovation mission to Israel. And here's what he said, quote, collaboration is key to serving the common good of our citizens, and the Commonwealth is thrilled to expand our partnership with Israel, end quote. At this deal-making summit with Israel, he said, again, this is the governor, we want to do good while also doing well. So he thought, you know, this is going to bring milk and honey probably to Massachusetts profiteers, you know. So soon, water became a key component of the Massachusetts-Israel Innovation Partnership. Now, this is a partnership which has lots of different aspects to it, in high tech and so on, but water soon became a very key component. This partnership, or MIIP, for Massachusetts-Israel Innovation Partnership, is based at the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center, or MassCEC, which was created by the state legislature in 2008 to develop clean energy projects. Massachusetts agreed to provide $250,000, matched by an equal amount from the state of Israel, for the winners of a yearly innovation challenge featuring collaborations between Massachusetts and Israeli firms in joint water projects. Now, this partnership around water grew with subsequent government-sponsored trade missions and the joint water tech summits, which were held in 2013 and 2014. And by the last year of the Patrick administration, MassCEC and the Israeli Minister of Industry, Trade, and Labor's, the Ministry of Industry, Trade, and Labor's Office of the Chief Scientist, that's our collaborating partner in Israel, announced a global water innovation network to push their technologies onto the global stage. So that's where things were at when the Patrick administration left office. Now, while all of this was going on, some of us, including many in this room, were doing our own organizing. We had, of course, long been aware of the growing business connections of all sorts between Israel and Massachusetts, mainly in fields like IT, life sciences, and, of course, security, right? They're the leading security, national security experts. But collaborating with the Israeli water industry for commercial gains did not strike us as business as usual, since water is essential to life, to the ability of Palestinians to stay on and cultivate their land. There's something more here than just a business collaboration. Israel's discriminatory water practices have long violated international law and UN rulings, and in its water deals with Israel, the Patrick administration put profit in the driver's seat and left human rights in the dust. So we formed the Boston Alliance for Water Justice, and there were some handouts here to describe what it is. Although our immediate goal was the termination of the Israel-Massachusetts Water Partnership, we recognize that the fight for water justice is local as well as global, and will doubtless be intensified as water insecurity grows in decades to come. So we are now making connections with groups working on water issues from Chelsea to Detroit, and welcome organizations to join that agree with our core principles, which are: water is a human right, water should be equitably distributed, water should not be privatized, and water should not be used as a tool of political oppression. which is clearly what Israel is doing. So what have we accomplished since we began organizing in December of 2013? Our first task was to inform ourselves, and we have been fortunate to tap the expertise of this university, of Tufts professors and students who have carried out water research in the West Bank. Then we set out to inform the public by producing and distributing education materials, publishing articles, giving talks. Some of the materials were here. I'm sorry if the copies ran out. We were able to target Governor Patrick and key figures in his administration in a manner they could not easily ignore. We hand-delivered to them letters written to the governor personally by the children of Ida and other West Bank refugee camps, describing what it is like when the taps are dry for months at a time. Here is what 15-year-old Ahmed wrote to the governor. "I don't know what kind of work you are doing with Israel over water, but I'll tell you that you are supporting the occupation and violating human rights. Do you know that Israel steals most of the water and leaves almost nothing for us? Do you know that we don't have enough water to take showers in the summer, to clean the house, to clean our clothes, and sometimes we don't have enough water to drink because Israel doesn't care about us?" 16-year-old Hala from Beit Jibrin camp informed the governor that, quote, "Right now, water didn't come to our house in the camp for over 25 days. We advise you to rethink your work with Israel because you are supporting a state that is killing us in so many ways. When I see a settler in Gilo settlement near us enjoying the swimming pool, green areas and a shower every day, and the refugee camp, in the refugee camp, we don't get enough water to drink because the settlers are using our water, I get angry. I get angry when I hear that people from outside are coming to help them steal our water, making our lives even harder." So in addition to distributing these letters, the children's letters to the governor and other officials, we got their voices featured in an online publication and on Patrick's call-in radio program and organized our own call-in to the government's office using these letters. Now, our main target has been the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center, where the water partnership is based. And before its head, Alicia Barton embarked on another water trade mission to Israel in June 2014. A group of us, including one of the Tufts water experts who I see in this room, thank you for coming, had a meeting with her and some of her colleagues. We laid out the case why, in the matter of water, it was ethically wrong for the Commonwealth to view itself as a natural partner for Israel, as Barton herself had once termed it, echoing former Mekorot head Buki Oren. We urged her to visit the West Bank to see how Israel was using water as a weapon against the Palestinian people. And we kept the pressure up by sending hundreds of postcards signed by members of the public to the Mass CEC and by holding a spirited demonstration outside of its offices on World Water Day last March. Among those who took the literature we were distributing to passersby were two Mass CEC staff members, those who had actually, fortunately, oversight over just our subject, the water partnership. They invited us to talk further, which we subsequently did, seemingly to sympathetic ears. I mean, they seemed to really want to hear about the situation. So what have been the fruits of the campaign so far? We cannot say with any certainty right now that the case we made to Mass CEC and the pressure we applied has caused it to put the innovative water partnership with Israel on the back burner. But we are told that is where it is today as the agency sets its course under a new administration. In the months ahead, we hope to get a clearer sense of what involvement, if any, the state government will continue to have with Israel's water industry. Whether or not the partnership survives in its current form, we have our public education work cut out for us as water becomes a growing profit center for both Massachusetts and Israeli businesses. The New England Israel Business Council has close ties to the recently formed New England Water Innovation Network. And the move of Desalitech, a Tel Aviv startup with close ties to the Israeli water company Mikorot, to Newton, Massachusetts, to increase its competitiveness in the U.S. and global market, may be a sign of things to come. It is now, you might have heard, getting substantial media coverage for teaming up with Harpoon Brewery to produce beer from the Charles River. Has anyone stay away from that beer? So there is much more to do to educate the public about Israel's water practices. And please sign up. There's a sign-up sheet over there. If you would like, it's not there anymore. If you would like to get involved with our work, and you should also see to what you can do to help ensure that the Ida camp in Bethlehem, that its residents have control over their own water supply. You could learn about this, what's called the Ida Water Garden, which is now going to be created, through One for Three's website. It's work that's really being pioneered right here in Massachusetts, and we all can play a part. So that's One for Three.
And Andrew's going to talk about that.
Okay, great. So I want to give the last word to Ala from Ida Refugee Camp, who addressed a letter not to the governor, but to, quote, all Americans. We know that you support Israel, and you'll never support us, Ala writes, except a few of you who believe in our rights as humans. All what we ask you to do is to educate yourself a little bit about what Israel is doing to us in terms of killing, stealing our lands, demolishing our homes, and, of course, stealing our water. They do all of that and most with huge help and support from you. We don't care if you support them, but don't kill us because we have done nothing to harm you. As you people say, have a good day. And go. Thank you.
That was Elaine Hagopian and Nancy Murray speaking at Tufts University on the Palestinian-Israeli water struggle. We're out of time, but This Week in Palestine will continue to cover the work of the Boston Alliance for Water Justice as it works with a new administration on Beacon Hill. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.